Okay. Can someone tell me what Jesus' ethnicity was? Call it out. Jesus was Jewish. Okay. That is very important. How do Jewish people think about the law? Any ideas? Just sort of the way we treat scripture, just sort of something inspirational to read now and again. It is the absolutely central piece of their lives, actually. Scripture, the Old Testament, is absolutely the central piece of their lives. But it wasn't always that way. So remember, in the past, we have done some series where we have been focusing on the Old Testament, and we've talked specifically about the exile. So it wasn't always the case that Scripture was central to who the Jewish people were. They, you think of sort of the height of the Jewish nation, the nation of Israel at the time. David and then Solomon, his son. These guys are like the peak of the Old Testament story. And then after that, it's all downhill from there because the people start to walk away from the Torah. They start to walk away from their scriptures, from their law. And so as wicked king after wicked king after wicked king comes to the throne, God starts sending prophets to the people. And he says, guys, don't forget about the law. That's what the prophets are doing. All the prophets are doing is saying, God's telling you to remember what he's already told you. And it just goes generation after generation after generation. And eventually, God gets fed up. God is patient. God is not infinitely patient. And so after enough warnings, God says, okay, I am going to send you people into exile. And they go into exile because they have abandoned the law. They have abandoned Torah. Babylon comes in. Babylon destroys Jerusalem. They destroy the temple, and they take everyone there captive to Babylon. That's what they do. It is absolutely scarring for these people. Have you ever encountered either a person or maybe an animal that has been beaten? Have you ever seen the reaction that happens when you make a sudden move around that person or around that animal? They're skittish, right? Have you ever seen that? I have seen it. I'm sure you have as well. There's like this instant reaction, like there's like just this thing that just this reflexive reaction that automatically happens. Well, that's what happens as a result of the exile to the Jewish people. They start to get really skittish around what's going on with the law. Are we going to be breaking the law in the future? Because they go into exile and it scars these people. And now suddenly, when they come out of exile, they become a people of the book in a way that they were not previously. Now, this book, this Old Testament law, becomes absolutely central to who they are. So they come back into their own land, but they still have these overlords. First it's Babylon and Persia, and then eventually sort of the regime changes, and then it's the Greeks, you know, Alexander the Terrible, Alexander the Great, right, conquers the entire known world. So the Jewish people are still subject to him, but the overlords keep changing. And after the Greeks move on, it then becomes a Syrian ruler in Judea, in Palestine. The Syrians are now in charge. And most of those previous rulers were quite happy to let the Jewish people be Jewish. In other words, they were quite happy to let the Jewish people practice their beliefs, practice the law, read Torah, observe it, and so on. And they have to do that because they're so scared that if we break the law again, we're going to go back into exile. They're skittish. They've become this skittish people. So we are going to keep the law as carefully as we can. But when Syria takes over, suddenly there's a problem. Because this Syrian king, who's overseeing Palestine, doesn't like Judaism. This guy wants to establish Greek religion and Greek culture, and he wants to enforce it on his Jewish subjects. And now they have a problem. They have a problem because they remember what happened in the past. They remember the exile. We abandoned Torah and God sent us out of the land. He destroyed this place. We can't let this happen. And the Syrian king says, yeah, it is going to happen. You are going to follow Greek customs. You're going to follow Greek gods. And you're not going to be practicing Jews anymore. And they say, uh-uh, not going to happen. And he says, uh-huh. And he says, I'm going to bring my army in and make sure that that happens. And the Jewish people think, okay, maybe that this is a test. So he brings in his army, and he starts telling the Jewish people, you can't keep Sabbath anymore. You can't circumcise your kids anymore. You can't keep those dietary laws anymore. He forces the Jewish people to eat pork. He forces them to make sacrifices to foreign gods. You can read about all of this in 1st and 2nd Maccabees. He actually sets up an idol to Zeus in Yahweh's temple. Like, can you imagine the effect that this has on the Jewish people? And some of them resist. Some of them resist. And in fact, what happens when they start to resist, mothers have their sons circumcised. And when Antiochus Epiphanes, the Syrian king, and his army, when they find out that that's happened, they take the mother and they take the baby and they take them to the top of the wall of Jerusalem and they throw them both off. When people start keeping Sabbath, in spite of what this king has said, they burn them alive. They start boiling people alive for keeping food laws. This is the background. That is what we need to understand when Jesus is having a conversation about the role of the law with Jewish people, because that's in their very recent history. These people don't have CNN, and we get breaking news, and we constantly hear about the next crisis around the corner, or it's just happened. Like, none of us even remembers the shootings from a couple years ago, right? Like, it's just, wherever that was, we've now moved on. They don't have that. These people remember the exile. These people remember what Syria did to them. They haven't forgotten. Their great-great-grandparents, some of them were flayed alive for keeping Torah, because Torah is absolutely central to who these people are. Now, you got to keep that in mind, because what's Jesus going to do here? Let's find out. Jesus is going to come and say, I've not come to abolish the law and the prophets. I've come to fulfill them. So let's talk about that. The law. The law is the first five books of the Old Testament, Genesis to Deuteronomy. Sometimes known as the Pentateuch, sometimes known as the Book of Moses. It's got a lot of stories in it, but it does also have a lot of laws. So this is where the Jewish people find out about what the do's and don'ts are. This is where they find out about their purity laws. This is how they find out what it means to follow Yahweh. They look to the books of Moses. They look to the law. And what is the purpose of the law? The purpose of the law is to create a people who look like God. But not just who look like God, there's a mission behind that. So if you want to follow this up, look at Deuteronomy 4. I don't have time to read it for you, but the first couple of verses of Deuteronomy 4 actually says that the purpose of the law is so that the nations around are going to see what you are like. Because the purpose isn't just that I become a better person. The purpose is that people see Christ, people see God through me, through the way that we live. And in fact, we just talked about this last week. Rob spoke about this. Jesus has the exact same thing in mind. You are the light of the world, right? He's actually getting that from Isaiah chapter 60, where the nations, Isaiah says that the nations are going to come to the light of your shining. You are going to be a certain type of people. God is going to make you a certain type of people as you keep the law. And as a result, the world itself is going to be changed. God has a mission behind it. It's not simply that we obey some ethical teachings and that's it. God wants to actually change the world through people who look different because they look like him. So that's the law. The prophets. I haven't come to abolish the law or the prophets. This is really a way of saying the Old Testament as a whole. Law is those first five books. The prophets are pretty much the rest of them. Jewish people actually think of the prophets to include both Joshua, Judges, 1 and 2 Samuel, 1 and 2 Kings, as well as what we think of the prophets, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, etc. Okay? So this is sort of a shorthand way of Jesus saying, I have not come to abolish what we would now call the Old Testament. Now, what is he saying? Not, I haven't come to abolish it. We need to think about that. Why would he say that? The only reason that he would say, I haven't come to abolish the law, is if he is about to do something that actually looks like he is setting it aside. So we have to keep this in mind. Jesus is going to hold a tension here that I find it very hard to understand and very hard to explain. He is not setting aside the Old Testament. And we see this in Jesus' ministry. He constantly quotes the Old Testament. The New Testament writers do the exact same. They're constantly going back to understand who Jesus is in the light of the Old Testament. So it's not that the Old Testament is invalid. So I think that even just as Christians, we need to hear this. He has not come to abolish this law. And then he goes on and says, not one jot or tittle is going to fall away from it. This is our book too. We need the scriptures, not just the New Testament, not just the Gospels. We need the Old Testament as well. At the same time, Jesus is not going to come and just carte blanche endorse the Old Testament as it is, because something has changed. Something has changed. And he can't make it any more clear than it is. It's not really that clear. Jesus is sort of like, you're just going to have to wrestle with this, friends. I haven't come to abolish it. I've come to fulfill it. And it's not an easy either or, sort of either completely bless it or completely leave it to the side. Jesus is going to do sort of both in different scenarios. And we just have to wrestle with that. He says, I haven't come to abolish, but to fulfill. We tend to think of the word fulfill to mean predictive prophecy. I am going to say that this is going to happen in the future, and then that takes place, it has been fulfilled. Matthew never uses the word fulfill in that way. So you have to look back at the different, he uses fulfill 10 times, the Greek word is plerao. He uses that Greek word 10 times, and not one of those instances is a time where he says something in the past is going to predict what's going to happen in the future. It's not that Matthew doesn't believe in predictive prophecy. He just doesn't use that word to describe it. You're going to have to chase those down. I can give them to you afterwards. Google is now amazing. Google has been amazing for a while. But Google, I often find that when I can't find a verse in my incredibly expensive Bible software program, Google often does a better job. So if you want to go and find all of the instances of where this word fulfill occurs in Matthew, just go to Google. They'll bring them all up for you. Out of Egypt, I called my son. Matthew quotes that we talked about that a couple of weeks ago. Out of Egypt, I called my son. And then Matthew says, this was to fulfill. But out of Egypt, I called my son is not predictive prophecy. If you just go back and look at the context, it's quoting Hosea, which is then alluding to the Exodus. And neither one of these are predicting Jesus. Like, neither one of them. It's very clear when you just look at the Old Testament context. Jesus comes and says, John, you've got to baptize me in order to fulfill all righteousness. Well, that's not predictive prophecy. Something else is going on. When Matthew uses the language of fulfill, we talked about this a couple weeks ago, I'm just going to use the same analogy again. He's talking about a pattern that was established in the Old Testament, and now something like that pattern is happening here in the New Testament. And in fact, what's happening here in the New Testament is an even greater expression of what happened in the Old. That is the way Matthew understands the language of fulfill. That is a very different concept for us to understand. I'm sorry, I just can't make it much easier than that. So I have up here a sundial. The people who invented the sundial never thought that one day there would be a digital clock, right? But a digital clock fulfills the sundial, okay? Not predictive, but something that has established, has brought to fulfillment the purpose for which this previous thing was put in place. These are not perfect analogies. A seed to a flower. Again, not perfect analogies. Because Jesus is going to go on and say, that I am fulfilling that, but then this still has a role. So this is why this is a really challenging verse. I have wrestled and wrestled with this all week long. In fact, there are like 15 different opinions on what fulfillment means. And the reason I am only giving you this one is because I'm trying to establish what Matthew himself understands by the use of this word. If you want to chase down those, talk to me afterwards. We can sit down. The New Testament has a couple of different ways of talking about Jesus' relationship to the Old Testament. I'll put them up here for you on the screen. I'm not really going to describe them in much depth. You can chase those down on your own. We always put the slides on the internet, by the way. So if you want to not only listen to the teaching again, but then you can go back and get those resources as well. The law is a shadow of Christ who is to come. Like a person who is approaching a doorway and the people on the other side of the doorway only see the shadow approaching. That is the way that Paul is thinking of the law, pointing to Christ. The law is the shadow. Christ is approaching, but when Christ comes, we want Christ himself, not the law. That's what Paul's saying in Colossians there. Galatians 3, the law is considered a nanny. It's considered a tutor. For people who are immature, you get the law. But when maturity comes, i.e. Christ, the law now has a different role. Romans 10:4. Christ is the goal of the law. Some of your translations will say the end of the law. The Greek word is telos. It does not mean that the law is finished. That's not what end means. We talk about ends and means. The means are the way to get to the end, but the end there means goal, right? Ends and means, goal. Christ is the goal of the law. That's what Paul is saying there. John 5. Old Testament points to Christ. Christ claims that for himself. We now read the Old Testament through Jesus himself. Now here is why I told you that long story about the Jewish history. Can you imagine the impact that Christ's claims here have on people who have had parents die to keep this law? This is absolutely central to every part of Judaism. And Jesus says, now it's me. Like, this is astounding. This is absolutely unbelievable to the people who heard this here. No one questions Torah. They debate endlessly about how best to apply it, but everyone understands that Torah is absolutely central to Jewish life. It guided their very being. Every part of life is filtered through Torah for these people. It's written on their doorposts. It tells them what food they can eat and what food they can't eat. It tells them what clothing they can wear and what clothing they can't wear. It tells them with whom they can associate and whom they can't. It tells them how to be God's people. Weekly Sabbath, monthly and yearly rhythms of festivals where they celebrate who God is. It tells them how to understand what is right and what is wrong. It tells them who they are because of who they have been in the past and how God has worked through their history. It tells them everything about their present and their future and life after death and so on. Like, there is nothing that isn't spoken about. That they filter every part of life through Torah. And then Jesus comes and says, me. Like, do you understand the gravity of what is being claimed here? These people went into exile for not keeping this. Their grandparents died to keep this. And Jesus says, nope, it's me. Your identity now needs to take me into account. Like, I was about to let an expletive fly there. Oh my goodness. What is the claim on us? Okay, we need to read the Old Testament. We need to read the Old Testament. Maybe I should just say it, like, just leave it there. Christians, for so long, they don't understand the Old Testament. It's very difficult to understand. Totally admit that. But many of us were just like, okay, give me Jesus. As though Jesus is really simple and easy. Jesus is anything but simple. Old Testament is easier. Let's read the Old Testament. It prepares us for Christ. It has ongoing testimony to who God is. And it has, Jesus does say in this passage, it has ongoing significance. Not one jot or tittle is going to fall away. At the same time, Christ is claiming that he is now more important and authoritative than Torah. He is going to be its official interpreter. What's happening in the early church, Jesus has died, he's resurrected, he has ascended. And you know what the early Christians, who are all Jews, need to do? They now need to figure out not how Jesus fits into Torah. Jesus has changed everything, and now they have to figure out how Torah, which was the center, relates to Jesus. The center of gravity itself has shifted. That's what's happening here. I don't know if you like this or not. You might find it a little irreverent. It's sort of like Monopoly. I hated that card. You have won second prize in the beauty contest. Like, it's like, they're saying now, Torah is now second. Like, Jesus shows up and says, I'm here, things have changed. You would have won first. You were first. But I'm here now, and it's second. That's slightly trivial and irrelevant. Irreverent, I'm sorry. But Jesus is now sacrosanct in a way that Torah was. And he is claiming that same thing for our lives as well. Jesus is absolutely the center of all existence. Have you seen the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy? It's such a terrible movie, most of it. But there's this one scene where these advanced beings, they create this supercomputer, and they program the computer and say, we want you to give us the ultimate answer to the ultimate question of life and existence and meaning and everything. And the computer speaks back to them and says, okay, come back in 7.5 million years. So in 7.5 million years, these people return to get the ultimate answer to the ultimate question of life and meaning and everything. And the computer says, okay, here it is. It's 42. And everybody is doing what you are doing. Like, they're silent. They're absolutely astounded by this meaningless answer. And then the computer says, no, really, I've thought it over quite thoroughly. The meaning really is 42. And no one likes it. Okay? Jesus himself comes to us and says, I am now the very meaning of life. That is the claim being made here. If Torah is central to these people's lives, if Torah is the basis around which everything else revolves, Jesus is now coming and saying, me. Me. Jesus puts himself at the very climax. And now everything else in the universe, all meaning, gets a new center of gravity. All meaning now has to take its very definition from Jesus himself. All of existence is redefined around Jesus. And that goes for whether we are Christian or not, friends. Our very life, our very existence is now redefined around Jesus. I was working this out and talking with Chantel last night as I was sort of continuing to puzzle through how am I going to preach this message. And Chantel's like, okay, well, what does that mean? And I thought for a moment, I said, okay, this actually means Jesus is now claiming that Jesus is more central to who we are, whether we follow him or not, than whether you are a mother, than whether you are white, than whether you are a daughter, than whether you are a teacher. Like, just everything that defines who you are now takes second place to who Jesus is. That's the claim being made here. If Torah is central to who these people are, and Jesus now puts himself at the center, he is the very center of the universe. And everything else gets redefined in my life and in ours. Okay, verse 20, Jesus says, for I tell you, unless your righteousness exceeds that of the scribes and the Pharisees, the religious professionals of the day, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven. Who are the scribes and the Pharisees? Scribes, these are lawyers. They are experts in the law. They're teachers. They are the interpreters of the law. Sort of if you combine modern-day lawyers with modern-day theologians, they probably would never overlap. Anyway, if you combine these two into one person, that's what these people are, and they function that way in a society that is almost entirely illiterate. Okay? Very, very few people can read, and even fewer can write. Okay? So these are the brains of the operation. Okay, they keep the laws, and they teach people how to keep them. They decide all of the judicial cases that they can. They're there to help the people out by understanding what the Mosaic law has to say about their individual lives. I think what Jesus is getting at is that there's a tendency for us to just prioritize knowledge. When I was in Bible college, I finally met some people that I thought could think. I grew up in a very, very conservative form of a Baptist church, and it was like, Jesus is really simple, everything is really easy, and then I got to Bible college, and I finally met some people who could think, and I got introduced to C.S. Lewis, and it was amazing, and my professors there were just, they were not only charismatic, but they just had a deep, deep love for God, which was equally matched by this profound wisdom, this profound godliness, and then a profound amount of knowledge, too, and I started to equate all of those. That was a mistake that I made. And I started to think that knowledge leads to godliness because now the most godly people that I knew were also the most knowledgeable people that I knew. And I think that's part of what Jesus is getting at here, that some of these people got really big brains and they never live it out. We got to be really careful about that. Thought is incredibly important at the same time. Right? Because thought precedes action. We get very upset with people when they don't think before they act, right? But thought, or what am I saying here? Thought must precede action. But thought that is left by itself without action is toxic. So let's be really careful about that. This is always about living. It's not less than thinking. But it is always about living. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. Romans 12, verse 2, right? 1 or 2. Be transformed by the renewing of your... this. Okay, this is part of it. And frankly, I grew up in a tradition where this was really not only secondary, it was almost condescendingly looked down upon, like this is all really simple and you don't need to make it any more complex. I don't know about you, but these verses are really complex, and Jesus himself is even more complex. It is worth thinking, and thinking carefully, and God is not actually honored by sloppy thinking. At the same time, thought by itself is toxic. Pharisees. I don't know if you've ever seen this at a zoo, but at a zoo, sometimes you'll find animals that have a cage around them, and then there'll be a second fence around that cage. If you can picture that in your mind, that is essentially what the Pharisees are doing in the first century. The cage, the inside cage, that's the law. The Pharisees come around, and what they do is they build that second fence around it. And you can understand why. Right? We just talked about the history. These people went into exile because they broke the law. And they say, never again. We're going to make so sure that we never break the law again, so we never go into exile again, they're going to draw boundaries around it. There's nothing wrong with that in and of itself. The problem is that those boundaries, they start holding people to in a way that becomes oppressive to them. So that's what's happening with the Pharisees. They start to invent more rules, and then they start holding people to it in a way that becomes really oppressive. If you're struggling with something, it is probably wise to build another fence around. Find the line, build another one around it. That's just wisdom. But don't then hold other people to it who aren't struggling with the same thing you are. Well, that's what the Pharisees are doing. In the end, your righteousness needs to exceed that of the scribes and the Pharisees. It has to go beyond thinking, and it has to go beyond rule-keeping. Jesus has a different kind of righteousness. Faithfulness to God now gets redefined around who Jesus is. And Jesus is going to spend the rest of the Sermon on the Mount saying, you heard that it was said, but I tell you, and so on. Like, there are some new laws that Jesus is setting out, and they all correspond to who he is. There's a new righteousness that is being set out here. Your faithfulness, your righteousness has to exceed that because there's a new standard in town. It's Jesus. And it's Jesus' way of living. He still says the Old Testament is still useful, but it's not the standard anymore. Unless your righteousness exceeds that of the scribes or the Pharisees, you will certainly not enter the kingdom of heaven. If you hear kingdom of heaven and you think going to heaven when you die, you have missed the boat in Matthew. This is not about heaven. This is not about, I got to do this so I can get to heaven when I die. He has just said a few verses earlier that the meek are going to inherit what? the earth. Not the meek are going to inherit eternal life. In a few more verses, he's going to go on and say, this is the Lord's Prayer, your kingdom come and your will be done on earth. Okay, I'm getting jumpy here. Man, I love this topic because it has been so profoundly misunderstood and it has so profound implications. God is deeply concerned about life on earth. And this is about the kingdom coming to earth. Jesus has absolutely changed things. It is his reign now on earth. God's reign now through Jesus and through what he is doing. It's a new situation. The law applied to the old situation, but the new one is here, and the law is going to have to get in line because Jesus is doing something new. Something new here. For here. So summing up. The moon orbits the earth. The earth orbits the sun. The sun actually orbits the center of the Milky Way. All of these orbit Jesus. That is how big Jesus is. That's sort of the claim of this text here. Everything in existence now orbits Christ himself. So please don't trivialize Jesus. Jesus is my buddy or Jesus is my boyfriend. Jesus is never your boyfriend and he might be your friend. But Jesus is first and foremost the very center of existence. And everything else now takes its understanding of who it is from him and ours or its relationship to him. Remember, Jesus replaces Torah. Torah is the very center of the Jewish people's existence. That is the claim being made here. Jesus is the one who says, existence now orbits me, and I am now the benchmark for behavior. I've got time to tell this story. Okay. I told this a couple weeks ago. I want to tell it to you again, though. In the Adventures of Narnia, you got the Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. You got four children who go from England to this mythical land of Narnia. Jesus is there in the form of Aslan. Aslan is the Christ figure in these stories. Okay, they defeat the White Witch, and everything goes really well. They establish this new reign in Narnia. And then after a while, the kids go back to their world. They go back to England. They spend a full year in England. They go to school. They get a year older. They all celebrate birthdays. And then they come back to Narnia in the next book. It's called Prince Caspian. In the next book, Lucy meets Aslan again. Lucy meets this Christ figure. And she notices that he's bigger. She says, Aslan, you're bigger. And he says, that's because you are older, little one. She replies, not because you are older. He says, I am not. But every year that you grow, you will find me bigger. If your Jesus is wimpy or small or boring, you either haven't met the Jesus we are talking about here today, or you have a very childlike faith that still needs to grow. Because Jesus is redefining absolutely everything. He is that central to all of existence. And that's why I want to follow him. And that's what discipleship is about. That's why I get excited. Jesus is the center of all existence. And he just gets bigger.